And we will wrap up the institutional features of the WTO, and after that we will examine two very, very important legal rules in the WTO, the most favored nation principle and the national treatment principle. And we will do a kind of a legal analysis, doctrinal analysis of the legal text in the WTO agreements. In terms of the organizational structure of the WTO, as you can see, the WTO has a ministerial conference. That's supposed to be the highest authority in the WTO. It comprises of the representatives from the member states, namely the ministers of trade, ministers of commerce. So anybody in charge of foreign trade affairs, international trade affairs, for the member state. So they come together, and there will be a ministerial conference every 2 years. And every year it is a high chance for every ministerial conference. It is a very good opportunity for the anti-globalization protestants to make a big show there. So the package negotiated through the informal process will eventually be passed by the ministerial conference. But the ministerial conference cannot operate, cannot manage the WTO on a daily basis. So daily affairs, daily matters is managed by the General Counsel, by the Secretariat. So as you can see, the General Counsel for Dispute Settlement Body, the General Counsel itself, and the General Counsel for the Trade Policy Review Body, that's the same body. They do just with different names when they perform different functions. For example, the dispute. That is because the General Counsel, the Trade Policy Review Body, and the General Counsel for and the Dispute Settlement Body, whenever they meet to make decisions, all members are entitled to present. All members are entitled to vote. So you can, as long as you are there, you can vote. You can vote. If you are not there, that is deemed that your lack of non-showing up, your lack of presence will be deemed as participation, as effective participation, as a yes vote, as a yes vote. So if you are not there, and under the General Counsel, you have a number of various committees for trading goods, for trade-related intellectual property rights, and for trading services, and for a number of other issues like environment, trade and development, free trade agreements, like the balance of payment, those kind of stuff. And in addition, because a number of countries are applying for WTO membership, there are also various groups for called working party to consider the application of application of nation states who want to join the WTO. And two very important countries are still not members of the WTO. One is Russia. The other is Saudi Arabia. That's two politically very important countries, and economically are also important countries. They are still in the process of applying for WTO membership. With so many committees, such a complex organizational structure, they're about several meetings. Sometimes can be more than 30 meetings every week in the WTO. So this actually, what's the problem for the smaller countries? If you look at the very complex institutional structure of the WTO and so many meetings a week, can every country, can every member state afford to attend all the meetings?
No,
you can't. Right? You can't. You need that actually. First of all, it's human resources. Human resources impose a huge constraint on many countries' participation in the WTO. So whether they can effectively participate in the WTO is actually is tremendously constrained by the resources. Actually, only less than one third of the WTO members have permanent embassies in Geneva. Of those one third, only a few member states can afford to participate in most of the meetings. So most of the countries cannot. 90% of the nation states cannot participate in those meetings. In the past, those countries are the U.S., European Union, Japan, and maybe a few other countries. Now China and India are also very active participants in those meetings. Although China doesn't say too much, but China attends almost every meeting to learn. So they are very quick learners. And the Chinese is also a member, a party to every dispute since it joined the WTO. So for China, that's a learning process. But it's also because China can afford it. So the WTO, although it's as seen from the very complex institutional structure and from its busy schedule, you can easily come to a conclusion that this organization is effectively controlled by those powerful nations. It is far from being a democratic institution. Although in WTO decision making, the laws provide that the WTO practice democracy. Democracy. WTO is probably the only international organization that practices democracy. So one member, one vote. One member, one vote. One vote for substantive matters. Even in the UN, you don't have democracy. As we have examined the operation of the IMF, in the IMF, money talks. The euro quota, euro share depends on the size of your economy. And in the UN, politics speak. The UN General Assembly could pass a resolution, but those resolutions are not legally binding. Most legally binding resolutions are passed by the permanent body of the General Council. Actually decided by the five most powerful nations in the UN. So that is not democracy. The WTO, according to its rules, it has a real democracy. You have one member, one vote. In addition, the WTO practices consensus as a principle that the WTO. That is very much a path dependent. In this regard, the WTO continues the practice of decision making followed under GATT adopted this since 1947. So every country has to agree. Every member has to agree. But there are a few exceptions to this general consensus rule. So you can vote, right? WTO and exceptional circumstances, the members can vote. So a resolution can be passed by the three quarters of the majority for implementation of the WTO agreement, or for waiver of the members' obligations. As we discussed a few days ago, one of the principles of the WTO is freer trade through negotiation. So every round of negotiation, every decision every meeting could only make trade freer, right? Make trade freer. But sometimes you have to allow a member state to make the trade less freer, to allow a member state to erect some trade barriers to save that country's economy, right? So those are exceptions, because that's a violation of the general principles of the WTO. So you need a supermajority, right? In the supermajority of three quarters majority, 75%, right? 75% majority for waiver of a member's obligation or for implementation of the WTO agreement. For implementation of the WTO agreement, here the WTO agreement means the agreement establishing the WTO agreement, not other agreements. We are talking about there are a number of agreements. here we mean this one, the agreement that establishes the WTO. And for other agreements, you can make amendments to these agreements, like GATT. You can have a two-third majority, right? But any changes made to the WTO's own decision making, for any changes made to this one, right, to change this three-quarter requirement, to change this two-third requirement, to change this consensus requirement, you need consensus. Need consensus to change those requirements, and also the core principles. Any amendment, any change made to the core principles, like the most favored nation treatment, like the national treatment, you need a consensus. Need the consensus to do that. So that's the WTO. But so far, the WTO has never voted for anything. Every decision has been achieved through consensus. The WTO has never put anything for voting, although there are those exceptions. So the consensus as a norm has never been violated. Right? So at most, you don't pass a resolution, right? But you don't put things on voting, right? So that's the decision making system. Right? The decision-making system, actually, from a political economy perspective, from an international relations perspective, it raises a very, very interesting question. How could, because the WTO practiced consensus, right, and also because the supermajority voting mechanism for fundamental decisions, unanimous voting for any change made to the core principles, I actually mentioned this a number of times, that the WTO is actually controlled by the powerful states, But how could they do this through the legal principles? Right? The legal principles, the decision-making process, certainly gives everybody the equal right. But in reality, it's controlled by the powerful countries. And it could only be controlled by the powerful countries. How was this achieved? So in the past, the decision-making negotiations and also dispute resolution. Dispute resolution now is more rule-oriented. Let's say the decision-making system, including the negotiations, in the past, it was controlled by the so-called Quad, the U.S., European Union, Japan, and Canada. Now, with the accession of China, now the most powerful nations, they're called the Group of Seven, the G7, in the WTO, so U.S., EU, India, Australia, China, Brazil. So those seven countries, they determine the results of WTO negotiations. And China has been included into the core group. China is actually one of the most powerful states in the WTO. So China could decide, could make decisions for other countries. other countries. So if these seven nations, if these seven members can reach agreement, and they can force, they can actually force other states to accept it. Mm-hmm. Now the WTO has 153 member states. So these seven states, if they could reach an agreement, they could impose the agreement upon those 146 member states. In the past, it was the Quad, US, European Union, Canada, and Japan. Japan is also included in the group of seven. So how could those powerful states achieve this, given that the WTO indeed has democratic decision-making process, one member, one vote, and consensus. So what do you think? I have actually pointed out one reason that it's actually very difficult for those small member states to have effective participation. They can't. Right? They can't. You just can't even participate in those meetings. So economic, the human resources constraint, the budget constraint would prevent you from participating in the decision-making process effectively. That's certainly one reason, but that's not all. That's not all. Any other reason that small developing states cannot have effective participation in the WTO decision-making process? Please, Cal.
I think the G7 probably constitutes most of where the world's consumable goods are sent to.
Right,
and
yes.
So if those small nations want to be able to trade with the US, Japan, places where people actually have disposable income,
right,
then
yes.
They're going to have to submit to those countries.
Right. That's very, very correct. Indeed, the G7 countries represent 70 to 80% of the world market, right? If you consider the size of the US, European Union, China, and Japan, right? Those are four most economically most powerful countries. They represent indeed most of the world economy. Right? So they are economically they are very important. Right? But this still doesn't explain how could they, because we have a contradiction here. We have a disparity in terms of their size of economy, in their bargaining powers, but we also have democracy here. We have democratic principles. Right? So because so far, almost all the decisions have been passed by consensus. So this effect shows that no developing state, not even a single small members of the WTO ever raised objection to this. Although those decisions actually harm their interest. Some of the decisions indeed harm their interest.
They negotiate before the WTO's meeting.
Who? Yes, indeed. Those decisions, you are right. So most of the agreements, most of the results were negotiated in the informal negotiations between those powerful states. And the member states, those ministers, so they came to Singapore, they came to Hong Kong, they came to Cancun, they came to Seattle, and they came to Geneva. They only went there to vote. They stay there for a few days, for a week, just to vote. They push the button. So most of the negotiations were actually conducted through informal channels. In national capitals, you see the USTR visit USTR, Susan Schwab visited Beijing and stayed in Beijing for 1 week. Those are real negotiations, right? Or Mandelson, the former European Union Trade Commissioner, visited Washington. Negotiations were actually conducted there. But we do have democracy here. If you are one of the seven most powerful nations, one of the G7 state. And there are actually two things. First, how could the G7 achieve consensus on the results? They haven't. For the Doha round, they haven't. They haven't. So the Doha round negotiations failed again and again because the group of seven haven't achieved anything. But assuming they can someday they could achieve something, how could they sell this to those 147 and 46 states? So they have to accept it. Almost no amendment. Almost a fast track. If the G7 achieve consensus on certain things, those things will be passed, will be adopted by all the member states, So what kind of, if you are negotiators, I actually participated as a member of the PRC delegation, participated in some of the negotiations. Very interesting, very interesting.